This is a University of Otago podcast.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's wonderful to see everyone here tonight for this, the fourth public lecture in our series of seven. And all four of these are inaugural professorial lectures. For those who don't know me, I'm Peter Joyce. I'm Dean at University of Otago, Christchurch. Now, Professor Cameron, who I will introduce in a minute, is a member of our world-renowned Christchurch Heart Institute. And a couple of years ago, an anonymous donor is in the process of gifting $5 million to the university so that can be invested and that the money used to fund the Christchurch Heart Institute in an ongoing way. And if anyone's got $5 million, I'll take you out for dinner after this meeting. If you've even got $1 million, I'll take you out for dinner any day, any night you wish as to what's there. But if you've only got $5 and would like to help match, because the donor gave us the challenge that we had to match it. And so this gives the details as to how to go on loan and donate $5 if Vicky does a good job tonight. Anyway, Vicky Cameron did her first science degree at University of Otago in Dunedin, and after some time overseas came to Christchurch in 1982 and has largely been here apart from a postdoc here ever since. She undertook a PhD with Professor Eric Espiner, who's down the front of the audience here tonight, completed that, did postdoc, and has been on our staff since that time. She was promoted to professor 2 years ago, but because of earthquakes, this lecture has been delayed, as many of our lectures have. And tonight, she's going to tell us about tales of genes, gender, and genealogy. Vicky Cameron.
Thank you very much, Peter. Just out of curiosity, how many people in this audience here tonight have looked up their family tree, have done some research into their genealogy? Raise your hands. That's a huge proportion. Why are we so interested in our ancestry? Well, I think it comes from the fact that we want to answer this universal question, where did I come from? And that's the question I'm going to address tonight, but I'm going to focus on the area of genetics. First of all, I'm going to give you a very short story about my own genealogy and then introduce you to the brave new world of personal genomics. Then I'm going to shock you and amaze you by telling you that our inheritance is not just dependent on the information in our genes, but there are various other sources of heritable information that we get from our ancestors, including non-coding RNA, which has been dubbed the dark matter of the genome. Thirdly, because this is my inaugural professorial lecture, I'm going to give you a brief synopsis of my own career and my personal journey into genetics. And then last of all, I'm going to tell you about some of the contributions my laboratory has made doing research into the genetics and susceptibility to heart disease. So first of all, my story starts in the Western Highlands of Scotland in Clan Cameron territory. So the Cameron Territory is a region called Lochaber that has Fort William at the centre and runs down to Ben Nevis and down to the Morven Peninsula here. And the story starts in August 1745 when the chief of the Clan Cameron at the time, Donald Lochiel, was planting this avenue of beech trees leading up to his house at Achnacarry. He was in the middle of planting these trees when he got news that Charles Edward Stuart, known as Bonnie Prince Charlie, had landed in Western Scotland and was aiming to reclaim his crown, claim to the throne of England. Because the Cameron clan had formed an alliance and promised to give support to the Stuart cause for the English crown, Lochiel immediately just heeled in the beech trees, the beech seedlings that he was about to plant, and rushed off to greet the prince. And as a result, this avenue of trees was never completed, and the line of trees is a little bit wonky. So this is Donald Cameron, and he was known as the Gentle Lochiel because he had devoted his life to improving the living conditions of his clansmen. And he rushed off to meet this man, Bonnie Prince Charlie. And at first, Lochiel tried to, he was a peaceful man, he tried to persuade the prince from doing battle. But the prince, who was 25 at the time, had arrived from France with just a handful of men and no supplies, but he was determined that he was going to fight to get back the English throne. And he had been displaced, or his father had been displaced, by the Hanover line, so this, they were trying to restore the Stuart line to the crown. So the prince was so determined that he was going to fight that reluctantly Lochiel said he would gather his clansmen, as many of the other Scottish clans who were loyal to the Jacobite cause did, and the Jacobite rebellion, or known as the 45, began. Initially, there were victories for the Jacobite army. They won victories at the battles of Prestonpans and at Falkirk, but then at the Battle of Culloden, the Jacobite army was defeated. And in fact, the Clan Cameron lost half their men in that battle. The English wreaked a terrible... And Lochiel was wounded, seriously wounded, but he did manage to make it back to France eventually, along with the prince. The English wreaked a terrible revenge on the Highlanders who had allied themselves with the Jacobite cause. The Cameron land was forfeit to the government. Achnacarry was burned. And even more horrific, two of Lochiel's brothers, Dr. Archibald Cameron, was taken prisoner, taken down to London. He was hanged, drawn and quartered at Tyburn. And another brother, who was a Jesuit priest, was also taken prisoner in the Hulks, which were prison ships moored in the Thames, and he died of ill health in those prison ships. Now, I've slightly told a tall story here because I haven't actually managed to trace my genealogy, much though I'd love to be descended from the gentle Lochiel. My genealogy, I haven't made that connection to him as yet. But I have made the connection to ancestors who lived at the time of the Jacobite Rebellion in this rather desolate area of Scotland called Morven. And this is my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Duncan Cameron, who was the head of the household, the Cameron household of Funery in Morven. Now, I don't know when he was born. We don't have a date for his birth. But I think he must have been a small boy about the time of the Jacobite Rebellion. And what happened next must have forged their eventual destiny and probably forged the destiny of my ancestors who came to New Zealand. So a party of English sailors from the English Navy raided the area of Morven, where they burned all the houses and the crops, and they shot the cattle. And in fact, Captain Hay, who was in charge of this raid, boasted that they had burned 400 houses in a day. So what happened, I don't know. The first family that Duncan Cameron had, we don't have any information about. He had a second family, from which I'm descended, from this son, Hugh Cameron. And you notice that Hugh Cameron wasn't born in Morven, they were born elsewhere. So it makes me wonder if they had to leave the district after the 45 because of that was no longer hospitable to live in. So, genealogy. Genealogy tells us most about our male ancestors because the males were the ones who most of the documentation was about. But this is not true for our genetics. Our chromosomal DNA from our nuclear chromosomes actually gives us equal information from both our maternal ancestors as well as our paternal ancestors. And since the human genome was sequenced, there have been a number of companies set up that provide commercial genotyping ancestry information for a fee. So for $99, you can get genotyping for 178 diseases as well as ancestry analysis from this company called 23andMe. And it's called 23andMe because humans have 23 pairs of chromosomes. So commercial personal genome services are just a mouse click away. However, I do believe that the information you get is rather limited and that you might need to hire a clinical geneticist in order to interpret it. So I've talked a bit about DNA and chromosomes and genes, and I thought perhaps I'd better take a step back and just give you a refresher course on the substances that I'm talking about. So this slide shows a rather stylized cell. And in the centre is the nucleus, which is like the control room of the cell. And in it are our chromosomes. And if we take one of these chromosomes, we find it's actually one single long molecule of DNA, but it's tightly coiled and compacted into this X shape. And if we unravel it and uncoil it and focus in on it, you'll find eventually it reveals itself to this twisted ladder shape. This is the DNA double helix that Watson and Crick identified the structure of in 1953 and subsequently were awarded the Nobel Prize. But you'll also notice that this twisted ladder, The rungs of the twisted ladder are shown here in different colours, and in fact each half of the rung is shown in a different colour. And that's because the DNA molecule is made up of a set of molecules called nucleotides. And the nucleotides make up the halves of the rungs of the ladder. And there's only four possible nucleotides in the human genome. And they're given the letters A, T, C, and G. So our entire DNA code is made up of different combinations of the sequences of A's, T's, C's, and G's. Along the chromosomes are little codes that tell the cell start here and stop here. And the cell knows that that means when it gets to a start codon or code, it realises that the next sequence is coding for a gene, and that when it translates that gene, it makes a specific protein. So this is depicted again in diagrammatic form. Here's a section of DNA, and here's the chromosome is transcribed to an intermediate molecule, a similar sort of nucleic acid called RNA, and then it's that that's used as a template for the cell to make the specific protein. But you'll also notice in this diagram that one of the rungs on the ladder is shown in red and labelled polymorphism. Polymorphism just means many forms, but this is the most common sort of genetic variation that we have. And this is shown here again in a close-up. So this is a strand of someone's chromosome, and here in this position is a C and a G, a pair of nucleotides, and here is a T and an A. And because it's a single nucleotide polymorphism, it's called a SNP, single nucleotide polymorphism, and I'm going to talk a lot about SNPs in this talk. And just for convention, I'll explain that mutations are the name we use for rare variants. That's variation in our genes that's found in less than 1% of the population. And polymorphisms is a term we use for common variation. And there's no particular magic number with 1%. It's just a convention. So mutations are rare variants. Polymorphisms are common variants. And we all have thousands of polymorphisms in our genes. Since the human genome was sequenced, we know that 99.9% of our DNA is identical, but it's that other 0.1% that makes us all individuals, but can make us more susceptible to certain diseases. So if you were at Professor Martin Kennedy's talk about 3 weeks ago, this slide might look familiar. So Martin explained, now that you've grasped the concept of a gene, I'm going to make it a little bit more complicated. So genes not only consist of this sequence of nucleotides that acts as a template for a certain protein, but genes consist of exons, which actually have the coding system. But there, interspersed in that, are these non-coding regions shown in red called introns. So when the gene is transcribed to its messenger RNA, the introns are cut out and the exons are spliced together, and it's that strand that's used as a template for making proteins. Now, we know that humans have about 20,000 genes, and Martin explained that amongst those genes we have about 180,000 exons, but that's only 1% of the human genome, so there's a lot more information in our chromosomes than is just within the coding sequence of our exons. And Martin also pointed out that those exons contain about 85% of mutations, but notice he's used the word mutations here, not polymorphisms. So Martin also suggested that sequencing the exome would be a cost-effective way of getting new information about possible inherited risk of diseases. Well, I'm going to persuade you that the exons are only part of the picture, and there's actually a lot more information than we can just get out of our exons. Sorry, Martin. So, for many years, the technology only allowed us to look at our genetic variants one SNP at a time and one gene at a time. But that all changed in 2007 with the advent of a new technology called gene chips. And these are this is one manufacturer of gene chips. This is what they look like. And they're actually a piece of glass slide or a piece of plastic with an array of thousands and thousands of probes for variants within our genome. And this particular diagram shows an experiment with 500,000 SNPs arrayed on those gene chips. And the thing you can do with that, if you put the DNA from an individual on one of these gene chips, then you can see which of those SNPs they're carrying in their DNA. But what you can do is, if you have a very large sample of patients with a particular disease, and a very large sample of controls who don't have that disease, and you do put their, each of their DNA on gene chips, then the resultant output shows you which of those SNPs are more frequent in the patients than the controls, and this gives you some candidates for which genetic variants might be associated with susceptibility to disease. And this is just shown in diagrammatic form here. Martin also explained this in his talk, but this is called a Manhattan plot because people think it looks a bit like, the peaks on this graph look a bit like the skyscrapers on the Manhattan skyline. So this, you might be able to pick out that this graph is actually made up of a whole series of dots, and these dots, each of these dots represents one of those SNP probes on the gene chip. And the higher the dot is, the more frequent it is in the patients versus the controls. And you might also notice that these bands are labelled 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. And this is because these are the SNPs for chromosome 1, these are the ones on chromosome 2, etc. So when this sort of experiment is done, the higher the dot is above this line, which the line is the threshold for a genome-wide statistical significance, the higher the dot is, the more likely it is to be associated with susceptibility to the disease. But one experiment like this, even if you've got thousands of people in it, is not enough because the susceptibility, genetic susceptibility varies from one population to another. You need to have independent replication of your top hits. And those different experiments are put together in a meta-analysis, and that shows us which SNPs are really strongly associated with risk of disease, of a particular disease. But we were astonished to find that with thousands of GWAS, genome-wide association studies that have been performed to date for hundreds of complex diseases and complex traits, only 3% of those top hits are actually encoding regions of genes. So where are they? Well, many of the genetic variants associated with complex diseases and complex traits are in regions we once have called junk DNA. In this diagram of a section of chromosome, this explains some of the different features that are found in a chromosome. So the blue, pale blue area here is a gene, and the blocky bits are the exons, and the skinny bits in between are the introns. Remember, introns are actually transcribed to RNA, so you get RNA floating around from the introns. On either end of the gene, you've got regulatory regions like promoters and enhancers. And then you intersperse between the genes, you've got all sorts of other features like this long non-coding RNA. And so we now know that many of these areas of the gene that we once thought were DNA are actually are coded into non-coding RNA. And so the idea of junk DNA is really a myth. Oh, I forgot to mention there's another, as well as long non-coding RNAs, there's another feature that's transcribed from our chromosomes, which are called microRNAs, and they're little short bits of RNA that we do know actually help regulate gene expression. So you've got long non-coding RNAs as well as microRNAs. One of the really, really interesting things that they've found recently is that there's a higher, the more complex the organism, the higher the ratio of non-protein-coding DNA to protein-coding DNA. So that it was quite a puzzle when the human genome was sequenced that they found humans only had about 20,000 genes, because some very simple organisms, like a very simple worm called C. elegans, also has around 20,000 genes. And the question was, how can something as complicated, as an organism as complicated as Homo sapiens, have the same number of genes as something as simple as a basic worm? But what we think now is, so this graph actually shows all these little blue bars are very simple organisms, bacteria and other single-celled organisms. And as we go to the right, we get into increasingly complex organisms, with Homo sapiens at the far right of this graph. And then next to it is mouse. And then we have various other species. This purple one here is Drosophila, the fruit fly that's often been used in genetic experiments. And this purple one here is C. elegans. And you can see as the organisms get more and more complex, the ratio of non-protein coding DNA to protein coding DNA is increasing. So this might explain why with the same number of genes, you can get a complex organism or a very simple organism. So I've talked about non-coding DNA and RNA and the dark matter of the genome. Now I'm going to talk about a different sort of DNA, and this is our mitochondrial DNA. And this, so mitochondria are organelles that are found in the cytoplasm of our cells, and they're like the furnaces of our cells. I think Tony talked about this last week. So they generate, they burn oxygen and create chemical energy. But each mitochondrion has its own DNA, its own chromosome, which is a circular chromosome. And when we look at the circular chromosome, there are 37 genes in a mitochondrial DNA chromosome, and all of these are essential for mitochondrial function. Now, the really interesting thing about mitochondrial DNA is that we only inherit it from our mothers. So when fertilization occurs and the sperm fuses with the egg, the nucleus of the sperm fuses with the nucleus of the egg and carries our nuclear chromosomes into the new offspring. But the rest of the father's cell remains behind. So the mitochondria that the offspring gets, that the embryo gets, are only coming from the mother. So our mitochondrial DNA is all coming from our maternal lineage. And this is explained in this diagram. Here's the ancestry picture for our nuclear DNA. Because we get that in equal amounts from both parents, as you go back in time, you get a huge number of ancestors that are contributing to your nuclear DNA. But when you look at mitochondrial DNA, because you get all of your mitochondrial DNA from your mother, who gets it from her mother, who gets it from her mother, you can see that there's actually a single maternal lineage that you can trace back into distant time, back to a single woman from whom you've inherited your mitochondrial DNA. And this is the subject of a book that probably many of you may have read called The Seven Daughters of Eve by Brian Sykes. And Brian Sykes explained this story about he called them clan mothers, these distant relatives. And he actually took the clan mothers, the seven women who have given rise to most of those of us of European extraction, and he made up little fictional stories about them. He worked out when and where they might have lived, and he gave them names. So we've got Velda, Helena, Tara, Catherine, Ursula, Jasmine, and Xenia. And this is a really interesting book. It's fascinating, and I recommend you read it, and I also recommend another book by Brian Sykes if you want to get a good balance. He's written a book called Adam's Curse, which is about the Y chromosome. And yes, you can get your mitochondrial DNA commercially tested as well. So you can send in a sample of your mitochondrial DNA and they'll tell you which maternal haplotype group you've descended from. So I've talked about the non-coding DNA and RNA in the genome. I've talked about mitochondrial DNA. Now I'm going to talk about another method of inheritance that is not actually modifying your DNA sequence at all. This is epigenetics, which is a modification of your inheritance a modification of your genes without actually changing the DNA sequence. And it involves such a process like methylation, addition of methyl groups to the gene, which tends to inhibit the activation of the gene, it inhibits gene expression. And this is an example here. In this diagram, they've taken a strip of DNA which they've labelled the agouti gene, and if it's got no methyl group stuck to it, then it's active, and the agouti gene causes a mouse that's got an active agouti gene to have a yellowish coat and be prone to obesity. But if the DNA is methylated, the gene is inactive and suppressed, and the mouse has a brown coat and it's thin and healthy. Now, the really interesting thing about methylation is that during development, most of our methylation, very early on in development, most of our methyl groups are stripped off our DNA because the genes have to be as active as possible in order to allow the rapid growth and development during gestation. And then gradually, as the brakes are put on some of those growth processes, the methyl groups are added back on. But that process is very, very susceptible to environmental influences. And this is a way that your environment during development can have a profound influence on your health and other aspects of your physique, etc., later on in life. So that's one form of epigenetics. There are other ways that your DNA can be modified, which I'm not really going to talk about, like histone modification. The histones are little spools of protein that your chromosomes are wound around. This is that depicts the methylation I was talking about. But I'm not really going to talk about epigenetics anymore in this talk. If you're interested, there's a very good book called The Epigenetics Revolution by Nessa Carey that explains these processes. So you've probably had enough of talking about genetics for a while, so I'm going to digress and talk about some of my research experience throughout my career. My first research experience was as an Antarctic research assistant when I was an honours student at the University of Otago. And we were looking, doing research into the parasites of Antarctic fishes. And no, this is not actually me. This is my supervisor, Professor Warren Featherston. He was a wonderful supervisor and had a great dry sense of humour, a good person to be out in the wilds of Antarctica with. So what we were looking at was fish parasites, because we were trying to complete the life cycle of some of the parasites that Warren had previously documented in this fella, the Weddell seal. So Warren had found, you might know that a lot of parasites have their adult stage in a warm-blooded host, but they have their larval stage in a cold-blooded host that the warm-blooded host then eats and becomes infested with the parasites. So having documented the parasites in the Weddell seal, Warren and this research we were doing was trying to track down the larval stages in the cold-blooded fish. And we did this. We spent two summers fishing through holes in the ice and catching Antarctic cod and cutting them open and looking at the parasites inside them. And we did manage to find, and we documented a lot of parasites within the fish, and particularly we were pleased to find this little larval Phyllobothriidae tapeworm in the fish, which completed the life cycle of the tapeworm in the seal. So here we have the seal. He has a tapeworm in him. He excretes the eggs, which are ingested by the fish. The larvae develop in the fish, and then eventually the seal eats the fish, and the life cycle is completed. Now, one thing I didn't mention was that I was actually the first woman to ever live at Scott Base, and this had a number of issues associated with it, not least that there wasn't actually a female toilet in the old Scott Base. So they made a makeshift dunny for me in a cupboard out the back of the post office. There were also, I was a young, naive 20-year-old, and actually the base staff were very, very good, but they did used to occasionally play practical jokes on me. And just to recall one, we were kitting out for some snow and ice training, and the outdoor education instructor, who I trusted in my naivety, told me that the plural of crampon, which are those spikes you put on your boots when you're walking on ice, told me the plural of crampon was crampax. And I went around the base talking about crampax for 2 days until someone told me that wasn't actually the plural of crampon. One of the other advantages of being a woman living at Scott Base, or one of the few women in Antarctica, was that the US Navy helicopter pilots adopted me, and every time they had a spare seat on a helicopter going out into the field, they'd call up Scott Base and see if I could get the day off, and I'd go off with the helicopter. They'd literally ring up, I'd say, yes, I can take the day off, and they'd drop him to Scott Base and pick me up. And so I got to see lots of fabulous areas like the Dry Valleys, and this photo is taken at Cape Royds of an Adélie rookery and Cape Bird. So I got to see some places I wouldn't have otherwise seen. And of course, I love to spend time. In the old days, we had sled dogs at Scott Base, and I used to spend time with the sled dogs and the dog handler. And this, particularly remembering that it's daylight 24 hours a day in summer in Antarctica, this is a typical evening, taking the dogs for a run out on the sea ice, investigating these icebreakers that are cutting a channel through to McMurdo Station. So, after I graduated, I got my first research job, and that was at the Wellcome Institute, the Renal Laboratory in Dunedin. And this was my first boss, Elsa Goulding, who was my first role model as a woman in science and a fabulous boss, and we're still friends to this day. And we were studying bone mineral and kidney function. And it was my first experience of medical laboratory research. But I only worked there for a year because I was waiting for this person to graduate. So this... This is a young Aucklander by the name of David Christie, who subsequently became my husband, and I was waiting for him to graduate so that we could pack up our bags and go on our OE, which we did, and we travelled for about a year, and then we settled in London, where I ended up here. Actually, no, I tell a lie. I didn't end up at Wormwood Scrubs Prison. I actually ended up at the institution next door, which is Hammersmith Hospital. And there I was working for the Institute of Obstetrics and Gynaecology, and we were researching agents that cause cervical cancer. In those days, they didn't know what caused cervical cancer. We were growing in culture cells that make up the surface layer of the cervix, the cervical epithelium. And we're particularly looking at environmental substances that cause cells of the cervix to grow more rapidly, and we were interested in heavy metals. But one day I found that my cultures had got infected by something, and it turned out they were infected by this parasite that I hadn't heard of before, Trichomonas vaginalis. And this is what these little things look like. And I found that the Trichomonas was eating the cells of the cervix. And so we published this paper, which had really elegant pictures, scanning electron micrographs of these Trichomonas vaginalis parasites eating and eroding the single layer of cells in the cultures. But as a footnote, of course, now we know that a human papillomavirus is the major cause of the main types of cervical cancer. And the advantage, we didn't know that then, but the advantage of this is there is now a vaccine called Gardasil, which if given to young women young enough before they get exposed to this virus, is likely to prevent them from ever getting cervical cancer. After a couple of years in London, we came back to New Zealand and we settled here in Christchurch. And I was working at what was then known as the Christchurch School of Medicine, is now known as the University of Christchurch, and I was working with this gentleman, Emeritus Professor Eric Espiner. And Eric supervised me for my PhD, which I completed in 1988, and we were looking at the regulation of stress hormones, looking particularly at the link between the hypothalamus region of the brain and the release of hormones into blood. This process is shown in this diagram here. So if you're stressed, be it physical, psychological, or environmental stress, your brain detects that and activates an area of the brain called the hypothalamus, which releases a hormone called corticotropin-releasing hormone, or CRH, which acts on the pituitary gland, which in turn releases a hormone into the blood called ACTH, which then acts on your adrenal glands, which are little hormone secreting glands above your kidneys, to release the stress hormone cortisol. And cortisol actually negatively feeds back to inhibit the release of the CRH. What we were looking at was a whole lot of modulatory hormones, other hormones that might modulate the stress response. So we were looking at hormones that circulate in the blood. But the interesting thing is that about this time it was becoming known that a lot of the hormone systems that circulate in the blood also have parallel systems within the central nervous system. So they act both as circulating hormones but also as neurotransmitters in the brain. And the term neurohormone was coined for such for these factors. And that's what we were looking at. We were looking at these hormones that are known as circulating hormones, but seeing what effect they had in the brain. And by the time I'd completed my PhD, I realised that there was a new area called molecular biology that I really wanted to get hold of, the research tools, the molecular biology research tools, to allow me to trace the origin of some of these neurohormones. And I knew exactly where I wanted to go to work on these with these new techniques, and that was the Salk Institute. So the Salk Institute is an iconic building. It was designed by an architect called Louis Kahn, but that's not the reason I wanted to work there. The reason I wanted to work there was because this man, Professor Wiley Vale, had his laboratory there. And Wiley really could be dubbed Mr. Neurohormone. He and his team had identified a whole raft of these neurohormonal factors. I could list just a few of them. CRH, which I talked about in the last slide, was discovered by him. He discovered somatostatin, growth hormone-releasing hormone, the urocortins, activin, inhibin. The list goes on and on. So it was incredibly exciting working there. I was right at the hub of discovery in my field. And the papers we were putting out were absolutely cutting edge. As well as that, Wiley was a really nice man, an intellectual giant, and also a real family man. He used to come around the lab at 5 o'clock some afternoons, and all the people who had children, he'd tell them it was time to go home. And by this time, we did have children. We had two little Cameron Christie clones. And initially, David had wanted to stay home and look out, do the childcare full time. But after about 3 months of living in an apartment in a condominium in San Diego, he felt he needed to work part time, and so he got a job. The Salk were very helpful, and they said, "Well, we have a position that would really suit you, David, because you're really good with computers. We've got a secretary who's going on maternity leave, and if you wouldn't mind just doing her computer work, well, actually, if you wouldn't mind answering the phone and making the coffee as well." So David worked as a secretary for a woman scientist at the Salk. And David loves role reversals. He's very happy with that, and he adopted this role quite happily. In fact, one day I was standing beside him and the phone went, and when David answered the phone and the person at the other end heard a male voice, they got very confused and they said, "Oh, I'm sorry to disturb you, Doctor. I wanted to speak to Catherine Rivier's secretary." And I heard David say, "This is she." So anyway, this was the sort of work we were doing. I'd learned this technique while I was at the Salkerd, in situ hybridisation, and that allowed us to map the distribution of some of these new neurohormones that were being discovered all the time. And this is a figure from one of the papers that I published at the time, and these are sections through rat brain, and the darker the pattern on the image, there are more cells and the stronger is the production of this. In this case, it's actually a receptor, the receptor for a neurohormone called activin. And you can see you get these beautiful patterns of the distribution of the production of these hormones. So nice that you really wanted to hang them on your wall. Anyway, after 2 years at the Salk, we returned to Christchurch and back to the University of Otago Christchurch, where I set up my own lab and continued to work on the molecular biology aspects of neurohormones. And at that stage, Lee Elmers joined me and did a PhD with me and stayed on. And we had great fun making lovely images like this of this one's of some heart hormones. In this case, it's the opposite, it's the negative of what you saw in the last picture. So the whiter the area, the more cells are producing, in this case, a hormone called ANP, and in this case, BMP. And this is mouse embryo at a very early stage. And then mid-gestation, you can just see the heart glowing with all the production of this neurohormone. And then this is just before the mouse is born, and it's all heart in this image. And we did other tissues. This is a mouse uterus, and this is a hormone called adrenomegaline. You can see these white cells glowing with the production of adrenomegaline. This was the first time adrenomegaline had been shown to be produced in reproductive tissues. But all the time, I was working with clinical colleagues like Mark Richards, because at this stage I joined the cardioendocrine research group, as it was known then, and Mark Richards and Richard Troughton here were clinical colleagues who it made me aware that we have a real problem in New Zealand. I really wanted now to start looking at the genetics of heart disease in real people. And this is a graph that shows an international comparisons of male mortality from myocardial infarction, which is otherwise known as heart attack. And the length of these black bars, each of these black bars represents a different country, and the longer the black bar, the greater the mortality from heart attack in men per 100,000 in the population. And you probably can't read the names of the countries, but I'll tell you that the top 10 are Eastern European countries, and the bottom one here that I've shown, I've added a label to, is Japan, and third from the bottom is France. And here's some countries that we like to compare ourselves to, USA and Australia, about a third of the way up this graph. But here's New Zealand, about two-thirds of the way up the graph. So we're really not doing very well in terms of our death rates from coronary heart disease. And you notice that we're tightly clustered with the UK and Ireland. And for those of us of Pākehā ancestry, this is where many of our ancestors came from. It wasn't originally on the graph, but I've added here the place where New Zealand Māori would sit. And you can see that New Zealand Māori have a significantly worse death rate from coronary heart disease than the general population. So I wanted to look at risk factors for heart disease, particularly interested in genetic risk factors. And you say, but we know the risk factors for heart disease. We know that smoking, obesity, lack of exercise, a fatty diet, and comorbidities like diabetes are risk factors for heart disease. But actually ranking alongside this is a thing called family history. And studies in twins have shown that up to half the risk of heart disease is actually inherited. And there's a lovely quote here that I've stolen from some people called Ramos and Olden. Genetics loads the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger. And we're very lucky in the Christchurch Heart Institute because we work alongside our clinical research colleagues who over many, many years have recruited a number of patients, large cohorts of patients, into research studies. And with the patient's permission, we've been able to get access to their DNA and look at genetic risk factors for heart disease. And this is just some of the cohorts that we have recruited over the years. They're sort of colour-coded, so these are people with coronary heart disease, over 2,000 in this group, and nearly 1,000 in this group, and the ones I've marked with gold stars are actually some of the ones I'm going to mention today. This group, the purple group here, are our heart healthy volunteers that I've been involved in recruiting along with Judith Thompson, my study coordinator, and we've got over 3,000 of healthy volunteers who are randomly selected from the Canterbury electoral rolls but are age and gender matched to our patient groups. I'll also mention briefly a collection of human heart tissue that we have access to through the Cleveland Clinic in the US, and I'll also briefly mention the Māori Community Heart Study that I'm involved in. So a little while ago I talked about how the technology only used to let us look at one polymorphism and one gene at a time, and that's what we were doing for a long period of time initially in my lab. These are called candidate gene studies because you have to choose your candidate gene as something that might you suspect might be involved in susceptibility to heart disease. And this is just an example of one of these studies. This is in a hormone system called the renin-angiotensin hormone system. And this is a system that maintains blood pressure in healthy people, but it's overactivated in heart disease, and it can contribute to heart disease progression. And this is work done by Anna Pilbrow in my lab. So Anna looked at the angiotensinogen gene in this system, and that has two SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, in it. And if you have both the high-risk forms of this, you'll have higher levels of angiotensinogen. And that might make you more, we hypothesised that might make you more at risk of a bad outcome in heart disease. And that's what Anna looked at. She looked at a cohort of heart failure patients genotyped for the high-risk versus the low-risk form of angiotensinogen. And when they were followed out for about 5 years, you can see that the people with the high-risk form of the angiotensinogen gene survived worse, had a lower survival rate than those with the low-risk form of the gene. And that was just one example of a candidate gene study. We've published quite a few of those over the years. But as I also mentioned, in 2007, that technology became obsolete with the advent of the genome-wide association study, or GWAS. And as soon as GWAS technology was available, several groups around the world did GWAS studies for coronary heart disease, coronary artery disease. And this Manhattan plot actually is a composite. It's a composite of several of these huge genome-wide association studies for coronary disease. And the higher the dots in this picture, the more those locations or loci on the chromosomes are associated with risk of heart disease. But you'll notice on this Manhattan plot, there's one position here on chromosome 9, which is head and shoulders higher than all of the other risk loci. And this is a region on chromosome 9 called 9p21, and it's the strongest risk factor for inherited heart disease that has come out of the GWAS. And although it's labelled here with these protein-coding genes that are near this locus, actually the risk locus is not located in any protein-coding genes. It's located in one of those long non-coding RNAs, some of the dark matter of the genome. What we looked at initially, because the risk locus had been shown to be associated with susceptibility to disease, we were interested in seeing if it actually had any influence on your outcome once you had disease. So in patients who had established coronary heart disease, this work was done by Katrina Ellis in my lab. What Katrina did is she looked at two of our coronary disease cohorts, the CDCS study, about 2,000 people in this cohort, and about 1,000 in the post-myocardial infarction study. And she genotyped them for the 9p21 risk locus. And these people had been followed up for many years, about 6 years in this case and about 10 years in this case. And although the patients with the risk form of the 9p21 locus were slightly younger when they developed coronary artery disease, what Katrina found was there was no association between the genotype and mortality in either cohort. So that's a little bit hard, a bit counterintuitive. So this risk variant makes you more susceptible to developing heart disease, but once you have heart disease, it doesn't seem to change your rate of progression, so you don't die any faster than somebody with the normal form of the locus. I mentioned that this variant was inside long non-coding RNA, and this long non-coding RNA is called ANRIL, which stands for antisense non-coding RNA in the INC4 locus. And here's the risk locus, so it's actually a whole series of SNPs that you tend to inherit together. And you can see that these are the nearest protein-coding genes, CDKN2A and 2B, which are some distance away from the risk locus. So we don't know currently what the function of ANRIL is, and we don't know how it could account, what its mechanism is for increasing your susceptibility to heart disease. But we've suspected that it probably had a regulatory region function, and it probably altered action or activity of other genes elsewhere in the genome. So to test this, we decided, and again this is work done by Anna Pilbrow, we decided to look in human heart tissue, and this was a collaboration with the Cleveland Clinic. So Cleveland does a huge number of heart transplants, and as a result they have a large tissue bank of hearts, both failed hearts that have come out of people who have a transplant, who've received a new heart and have given permission for their heart to be donated to research, but they also have donor hearts. So these are hearts that were donated for, given for tissue donation, for a heart donation, but for some reason no suitable recipient was found. And so we actually received these very small little samples of heart tissue, about the size of a frozen pea, and they came on liquid nitrogen all the way from the States. 108 donor sample, heart samples and 110 heart failed samples. And what Anna did was look at levels of activity or levels of gene expression of all 20,000 genes in the genome and looked for associations of those that were altered in association with the 9p21 risk variant. And this is what she found. This is a pathway with a whole lot of genes on it, and we know what Anna found was that the levels of Anril itself were marginally altered, but more significantly, these two protein-coding genes that are in the same locus had altered gene expression in association with the genotype, particularly CDKN2B. And then, downstream of them in this pathway, there were several genes with altered levels of gene expression. And what this showed, this gene pathway happens to be in controlling the speed of the cell cycle, so the speed at which cells divide. And so what we've found was that in association with this 9p21 risk genotype, in the middle of this non-coding piece of RNA, it was altering the proliferation of cells, and we suspect that this is the mechanism by which, we hypothesise this is the mechanism by which the 9p21 risk variant might increase your susceptibility to heart disease if it's speeding up the rates of cell division, particularly in atherosclerotic plaque in your arteries. But Anna didn't stop there with the heart tissue. She then formed a collaboration with a Swedish group who'd done very similar experiments, but in human artery tissues. And they generously let Anna use their data, and she combined the data with the arteries with the data that she had found in the human hearts. And that gave us an enormous statistical power, and we found the same pathway, similar genes in the same pathway activated in this combined data set of gene expression in these multiple cardiovascular tissues. In fact, it's the statistical significance is eye-poppingly significant. The probability of getting that finding by chance is 1 times 10 to the minus 258. So a highly significant association with altered genes in association with the genotype. So therefore, we've from this dark matter of the genome, we're proposing that this is altering coronary artery disease risk by speeding up cell division. I'm very briefly going to mention a study that I'm involved in with Suzanne Pietema of the Māori Indigenous Health Institute, and that's called Hauora Manawa, or the Community Heart Study. And this is a study trying to understand why Māori have that higher rate of coronary disease mortality compared to the general population. So we're looking at documenting diagnosed and previously undiagnosed heart disease, diabetes and their risk factors. And we're particularly looking in a rural Māori community in the Wairoa district and an urban Māori community in Christchurch. And as well, we have an age and gender matched non-Māori control group. And we've published about 4 papers on the study, so this is a very, very brief summary of the findings. But in a few words, we found that the rural Māori cohort had higher levels of some of these risk factors, particularly smoking, body mass index, and gout, which is an independent risk factor for heart disease. Gout was higher in both Māori cohorts. But interestingly, both Māori groups were more physically active than the non-Māori group. And really interesting and surprising to us was about 80% had attended their GP at least once in the past 12 months. We thought that the rural group might have issues with actually getting in to see their GP, but actually they had just as much as high an attendance with their GP. But despite the fact that they were all going to their GP reasonably frequently, We found that both the Māori and non-Māori cohorts had similar high rates of undiagnosed high blood pressure and high cholesterol. So we're now trying to find ways of disseminating this information to the DHBs and other health services to try and increase the rate of cardiovascular screening to try and get these risk factor levels down. Now, I can't possibly give this talk without making some comments about the state of funding of health research in New Zealand. Health research in New Zealand is almost primarily funded by the Health Research Council, apart from some charities like the Heart Foundation and the Cancer Society. And this graph was drawn a few years ago. I made up this graph showing the number of projects funded by the Health Research Council each year over a decade. And within each bar, there's the number of grants funded over the number of applications made. And you can see over the 10 years from 1994 to 2003, there was a precipitous drop in the number of grants funded. It's a bit hard to do the current update of this because the Health Research Council, or HRC, have changed their dissemination of funds, so there's more little pools of funding. But I did do the sums on the number of projects funded last year. In 2012, there were 28 projects funded out of 377 applications. This is in a success rate of 7.4%. And health research is just not sustainable in this country with the current rate of funding that we have. And it's because of this low rate of funding that the Christchurch Heart Institute have launched this public appeal that Peter spoke about earlier. And we're trying to build up a capital base of about 10 million so that we can actually use the interest from that to supplement our grant funding that we get from competitive grants to maintain our research portfolio. So if you want to support the ongoing research, like the research I've told you about tonight, pick up one of the brochures on the table outside and we'd appreciate any donations. Lastly, I had gender in the title, and although I've mentioned gender in passing on my way through this talk, there is a couple of things I just want to say. First of all, I think this cartoon expresses how I've often felt sitting at a table, the only woman with a table full of men, and sometimes feeling totally invisible. But there's a couple of other people I want to thank in association with this cartoon. And the first one is my mother, who I think the reason I'm a feminist is because my mother inspired me to be. My mother's 90 years old and she's flown up from Dunedin today to be here, so thanks very much, Mum. The second person who I couldn't have had a career without the support of my family and particularly my husband, David. I don't know if you've ever heard the saying, behind every great woman is a man trying to hold her back. But in my case, behind me is a man who's always been pushing me forward. So thank you also to David. And I'd also like to thank Peter because for 30 years my career was totally grant funded, living from project to project, and a few years ago Peter created some tenured research positions and I was lucky enough to get one of those. The next people I have to thank is my team who've actually done all the work that I've talked about today. So in this picture we have Katrina, Nicola, Lee, Barry, Alamanda, Anna, and me, and this is Judith. And this is in our office that we occupied for 2 years, an office that was kindly made available to us by our friends at the Māori Indigenous Health Institute. There were seven of us occupying this office while the building was closed for repairs post-earthquake. And the other thing I'd like to, of course, say is kia ora to all our supporters at the Māori Indigenous Health Institute that not only opened their whare to us, but also their hearts to us, and particularly Suzanne Pietema, who's the leader of the Hawora Manawa study. And of course, I have to thank all the participants in our studies, the Hawora Manawa participants, and all our patients in our research cohorts and our healthy volunteers. And lastly, I have to acknowledge the generous support of our funders, but all of these people, but particularly the Health Research Council and the Heart Foundation. And thank you very much for listening.